ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. The Green Dot is sponsored by Crew Chief Systems, the smarter way to manage, maintain, and safeguard your aircraft's value. I'm your host today, Flying Solo. My name's Chris Henry. I'm the museum manager here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Gonna have a fun episode today where we're talking to Matt and Jade Hofelt, and we are gonna talk just about the importance of general aviation flying. We're gonna have a lot of different avenues to go down today. Some good old-fashioned hangar flying as we talk about two people who are very passionate about aviation and making sure that general aviation is out there and accessible for everybody. So Matt and Jade, thank you guys for being here today.
Very welcome.
Happy to be here.
All right. So right out of the gate, the question I ask everybody on this is my favorite question to ask is, for each of you, how did you first sort of get inspired or excited to want to be involved around aviation?
I will go first, I guess. And I think my early stages of falling in love with aviation were really stories that my grandfather told me. He was a pilot, went on to become an air traffic controller. Him and my grandma went on many dates in their Taylor craft. I think the first time my grandpa's brother brought the Taylor craft home, they had a prop strike. So that was fun. And just hearing him talk about aviation inspired me to want to explore that more. I applied to Purdue and applied directly into their aviation program. So that is where I went and did all of my flight training from my very first flight up through my commercial multi. And that was almost, I don't want to date myself, but probably 24 years ago now that I got my license. But that was my initial inspiration.
That's awesome. That's got to be a hard date to top when you're, whoever your date is rolls up with their own airplane. That's a pretty cool date.
So. No doubt. No doubt.
That's awesome. And Matt, how about yourself?
Well, I grew up in Wanakee and we're good friends with the folks that created the Wanakee Airport. And my first time in an airplane was a sales incentive for Cub Scout troops selling M&Ms. The number one folks got to go in Don Rip's Cessna 172 and go cruise around. So there's pictures of us as little kids sitting on the wing of the 172 in Cub Scout uniform. So that was the first time. But a neighbor of mine, a story might be important later, was a flying club member in Madison and would take me up from time to time in a 1968 Cherokee 180 6494 Juliet, and would take me to Oshkosh along with my father. You know, we'd go up, and this upcoming summer will be my 37th in a row.
Wow.
Of going to Oshkosh. And the first airplane that I bought, I found at Oshkosh, and it was a 68 Cherokee 180 6496 Juliet. So made one back from the first airplane that got to kind of pilot. So
that's awesome. Isn't it wild how we could forget so many important dates or facts or something like that, but we all have these tail numbers that we remember, whether it was our first solo, our first airplane ride. I can still remember November 5712U was my first solo. You just don't forget some of the, they're just like, they're an old friend, you know, mm-hmm. You just don't forget their identity. It's pretty wild. When I heard you rattle off the end number, I thought of that right away. So tell us a little bit about how your, you know, career's progressed and landed you into some of the areas you're in now.
Sure. So after graduating from Purdue, I moved out to Southern California, land of sunny skies every day, really to build flight time and hopefully go on to become a corporate pilot. A friend of mine was working for a Cessna dealer at the time, and they asked if I wanted a job picking up and delivering brand new airplanes out of the factory in Kansas and bringing them back to California. Sounded like a dream job for somebody with 280 hours. And they put me to work flying probably between 700 and 900 hours a year. I was picking up new airplanes at the factory. That was kind of at the height before the financial crisis. We were doing between 50 and 100 Cessnas a year, with about half of those being new, half of those being pre-owned. And that's really where I built my flight time, got my foray into aircraft sales, and realized this is a pretty good gig. I work 9 to 5-ish, Monday through Friday-ish, and I'm flying brand new equipment, and it was amazing. So I did that for about 8 years and then moved back to Wisconsin, where all my family and friends were. Started working for a local FBO there in Madison and heading up aircraft sales for them. And that is where Matt and my paths crossed.
Yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
I had 6496 at the time, and my career was insurance and regulatory compliance, which is pretty boring in general, but the job took me all around the country. One of our main clients was Wisconsin Dells based water parks. And when we first started, they were truly Wisconsin Dells. And then the Kalahari, Great Wolf Wilderness, all three were accounts, started very rapidly expanding to all across the country, multiple locations. So I bought that airplane really out of necessity to travel and become much more effective with my time. So about half of the year, I'd be gone on the road traveling to all these different locations. And I used my airplane to do that. And Jade and I met at the FBO that she was working at the time. They sent out a newsletter, I guess quarterly probably, and it introduced her as new aircraft sales. Had her picture in there, and I decided that I wanted to meet her and did.
That's awesome. All born out of aviation, so that's a great story.
Yeah.
So I have to ask you, Jade, because so many of us don't fly new airplanes. What's it like getting into a brand new airplane straight out of the factory to go flying? That has to be a pretty cool new car, new airplane smell kind of thing going on
there. It really is, yeah. And that new airplane smell, like, it's just something you don't forget. Matt actually prefers the old airplane smell, just to be transparent.
Yeah,
it depends on what we're talking about. Our business and our interests take us really all over the spectrum, from vintage airplanes to brand new ones. What I will say, getting new airplanes, because I move them quite a bit now with one of the roles that I have, is things tend to happen in airplanes in that first couple of hours. The infant mortality of parts and whatnot. So a person also has to be very much on their game, that you don't have a trust with a brand new, you know, airplane, whether it really is something that is an old airplane you're flying for the first time or a brand new one. But building that trust and being on your game to handle situations is certainly part of the new airplane, you know, thing for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was very thankful departing Kansas, very flat lands, for quite a while until you have to cross some of the mountains, especially in a 172. And it was 14 hours from Kansas to California in a 172. And I was a lot younger back then, and I would do it in one day shot. But I would say 70% of the time I had parts fail. And most of the time it wasn't a grounding item, and we would just continue on and get it fixed when we had the airplane back to the dealer.
What was what's a more common part that would fail on something like that?
A lot of RPM gauges. So a lot of times those would go out. We'd have airspeed indicators go out. At that time, I was picking up all G1000 airplanes. So we had a full set of backup instruments, which really didn't cause quite a problem. Sensors, EGT sensors on the turbos are TIT sensors, a lot of CHT sensors. And you could almost always tell when it was a fake failure, right? It was just a sensor failed. But we'd get it on the ground, call back to the shop, decide if it was a go, no-go situation. But most of the time, getting it out of the factory, you were going to get it repaired quicker at your home field rather than waiting on the factory to put it back in queue to be worked.
Wow. So you guys meet at an FBO and then take it from there. What happens next?
We had a lot of discussions early on, and I was, I would say, beginning to feel bored in the career that I had, being gone all the time and just... It was neat, but highly repetitive. And we had a lot of conversations very early on about the experience of aviation, how it is to train, how it is to own, and how it is to travel the country. And those conversations became very focused on what those experiences were and what they weren't. And we decided that we would start a company that would address many of those kind of experience issues that we felt existed and did.
Well, and I think from a pre-owned perspective, Matt having bought the Cherokee, me having been involved in a lot of pre-owned sales, that a lot of times you know, for folks buying their first pre-owned airplane, that's a pretty big monumental event, right? From having your license, getting your license, to being able to afford buying an airplane, that's a huge investment. And even when we look at, you know, an older 172 that maybe could be bought for $125,000, people in the aviation world sometimes tend to look at that and go, ah, just an old 172. And I compare it to the car shows that we actively go to. And if you see a $125,000 car, you're not even breathing on the thing. And somehow the appearance of the same airplane doesn't get the same respect and, I think, celebration that we really wanted to see happen when people took delivery of their first airplane.
Yeah. And it just so happened that I was, at the time, renting a hangar at Madison at MSN, that the previous owner had built this bank of hangars, had had a medical issue, and had left for warm climate. And as a result of non-management, really some of the folks had gone and not been replaced. And I noticed that I was quite alone around that hangar bank. And I talked to him, and he explained the situation to me, and I took over management. Just said, hey, if I can help fill these up, you know, whatever. So he gave me free rent to kind of run the place. And through that process, we found out that there was some tax in arrears situation and some things that were going on. And through that process, we actually came to own that bank of hangars. So really the first thing that we did, the first business, you know, that we conducted was saving these hangars, you know, from a kind of perilous tax situation and moving owners into them, filling them up rather rapidly, giving airplanes homes, and eventually building a facility at Middleton at Charlie 29 on the west side of Madison on the very, very last buildable piece of land, a facility that we thought we'd never fill and got filled rather quickly, but a facility that would celebrate really aircraft sales and the monumental day, as Jade puts it, to do kind of quote unquote the right way. And that means, you know, beautiful lighting and red carpets and the whole fanfare that it deserves. And we started doing any and all airplanes that would come our way, from half built kits to whatever it was. We just wanted to help that community and do that. And we did.
Yeah. I think one of our early sales was literally pulling a trailer to a gentleman's house who was about halfway building. What was he building?
I think it was a Vans of some sort.
Yeah. And pulling the parts out of there to help him sell it. He didn't know what to do. He didn't have time to finish it. He wanted it to go to a good home, but he didn't even know where to start. So that was one of our early on sales.
And that process, the conversation, was one where we wanted to not only have the day celebrated, but also treat both sides of a deal with a high level of integrity and respect. And what we've seen, to Jade's point, for a lot of folks, that new airplane, they're reading about how to do it on forums and, you know, websites and things like that. And it can certainly be very intimidating. And people can get themselves into trouble doing that situation, not protecting themselves with the right documents and know-how and all of that. And we've seen customers that we've not represented in one side or the other come back to us to be represented when they were going to buy or sell, or, you know, what their next stage was, because of how they were treated. So that was a underlying core value of making the company.
Well, and you're absolutely correct that that's such a huge day. It doesn't matter if it's a brand new airplane or a pre-owned aircraft, you know, for both sides, but, you know, I like at it from the side of the person getting the airplane, that's a day they'll never forget. I mm-hmm. mean, that is, you're getting a member of the family, basically. I mean, if you're doing it right, you know, so that's awesome that you guys are doing that as well, of making it an event for the family, the owners, and giving it the correct fanfare. That's really cool. So tell us about, so that's what you do. You still do that currently?
Yeah. So Capital Flight was founded,
2013.
Yeah. So quite a number of years ago. And we always had the vision for what that was going to be. And one of the areas that we wanted to grow into was a complete ecosystem where, but for insurance, legal, and finance, we would be able to help our customers very much in a complete brand consistent way. So sales, training, maintenance of aircraft, and management. And since then have been able to do that, adding into our portfolio maintenance and really expanding all of those offerings with not just the two of us, but a team of many at this point, from instructors and whatnot. And it was very shortly after we opened our facility at Middleton, one of our on-field tenants had a brand new Cirrus, he and his wife. He said, "You guys are approaching things like Cirrus Aircraft does, very much an experiential and kind of taking things to the next level." And it wasn't long after that that Cirrus came to our hangar. A meeting was done and we became an authorized training center for Cirrus, and again, eventually moved into maintenance and eventually opened a second location in the Milwaukee area at Waukesha Airport and doing the exact same thing there. So,
yeah, I think between, you know, Matt and I's vision, bringing on very capable and talented individuals to round out our team, but then also strategic partnerships with both Cirrus and Aviat, which I'm sure we'll talk about as well.
That is super cool. And I love the idea, like you said, a contained ecosystem where really somebody can come in, learn to fly with you guys, or and then go all the way through to aircraft ownership and then maintenance, you know, keeping their aircraft maintained and even help, you've helped, you know, find hangars and stuff for it. It's a one-stop shop for everything. That's super cool. You know, because then you're dealing with the same people, the same faces, the same facilities. That's a really, really cool avenue to look at. I didn't think of it, something like that. You mentioned Aviat, so we definitely need to talk about that. How did you get involved? Well, it sounds like you kind of became a dealer for them, right?
Well, so how that went, actually, Jade took another job with Jet Aviva, which she can explain and talk about, but owner-flown turbine sale-oriented. So kind of rounding out the sales on the turbine side with a real established and phenomenal company as well. One of her early duties was planning regional events for Citation jet pilot owners. And we would get to go to those events, many of which were really, really neat places and some very, very cool folks to get to know in their own right, both pilots and, you know, business owners and things like that. And one of those events was just to the south of Alpine Air Park, which if no one has been to Alpine, it's probably one of the neatest places on earth to be a pilot, right? Mountains, gorgeous scenery, amazing homes, all this kind of thing. And we were at one of their members' private grass strips. And I just happened to be seated at dinner that night next to Stu Horn, Stu, the owner of Aviat. And we got to talking about, you know, life and business and what we like to fly. And I think what caught his attention was most of my past was sales and the organizing of sales teams and channels. And one of the things that they had struggled with was an aircraft manufacturer that used to have true stocking dealers. You know, once a year they would take an order. How many red ones? How many blue ones do you want? And they were really kind of out of it at that point. After the financial crisis, people just did not have the same temperature for stocking millions of dollars worth of airplanes in an inventory. So I said, I've got an idea on how we can have regional territory reps that handle this. Why don't we try it for a little bit, do a proof of concept, and then eventually roll that out. So over a couple of years, Capital Flight and myself became regional sales and maintenance for Aviat, mainly the Husky. And about a year and a half ago, with that proof of concept really kind of established, I took a role within the corporate structure to build the network of folks to do just what we do and train them how to do just what we did. So that's how Aviat came to be. But just a dinner, a casual conversation turned into, you know, really a passion. The Husky is one of my favorite airplanes, really, of all time. I love that airplane.
So we got to talk about the Husky here in a minute, but we really should mention, as we did sort of before we started, about the history of Aviat, how that came to be. Can you walk us through it just a little bit?
Yeah. So anybody who's traveled to the West has probably been to a Maverick gas station, like a Quick Trip or, you know, any of those sorts of things. Mavericks are plentiful in the West. And The Call family that started the Maverick gas stations also started Call Air, which was a aircraft manufacturer in Afton, Wyoming, which was building really purpose-built aircraft for mountain flying, kind of the rugged environments that they lived in. And eventually Call Air became agricultural, spraying and seeding airplanes as well. It really kind of took that direction, but it was the first kind of bush plane really manufactured for that purpose. And the factory eventually started doing parts for Pitts. There was a time where Frank Christensen, the designer of the Christian Eagle, wanted to buy the Pitts from Curtis. Curtis did not wish to sell. So Frank designed the Christian Eagle kit and therefore really changed kit building forever. Instead of just, here's plans, go on and have some fun, it became something that was a completely contained solution with all of the parts, all of the pieces, everything sourced so that you didn't have to do that. And by doing that, he really changed not only the kit building game, but a lot of inspiration into the competition aerobatics. So a number of years later, Curtis Pitts did sell Pitts. That owner, not promptly, but pretty promptly, turned around and sold Pitts to Frank. So he did get it eventually. And in that process, he also wanted to buy the Super Cub from Piper. And Piper and he had a deal, fundamentally, that ended up not going through. Piper wanted Frank to assume liability for all the previous built Super Cubs, which was just a non-starter. So again, in the face of rejection, Frank designs and builds the Husky 18 months from, you know, napkin sketch to certified airplane. And to this day, the Aviat factory is the longest continually operating aircraft manufacturer in the world. So a lot of rich history in that little factory in the Star Valley of Wyoming.
That is fantastic. I mean, you know, I've always thought they were pretty neat airplanes, but didn't know that nugget of their history there. That's pretty cool. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to fly a Husky?
You know, I think that it's become a very interesting thing to watch trends in aviation. You see, you know, experimental built to this, to that, and all these kind of different things. Well, one of them right now is STOL flying. And I think why that is, or a lot of the reason is, it never becomes mundane to fly a tail dragger. And it never becomes mundane to go to some of these places that only airplanes like that really can take folks. So I think it's brought a lot of value to aviation in that it doesn't get boring. And I hate to say, but you know, how many times around the pattern in a 150, you know, it becomes something that flying a tail dragger and the challenges of doing that and these sorts of things present a different value proposition. So flying the Husky is a constant challenge, but it's such an incredibly capable airplane. We own a J3 Cub, and there's nothing like flying a J3. Absolutely. But when you get in an airplane really with kind of the spirit of that whole thing and the challenges of a tailwheel airplane at all, but with three times the horsepower, with a heater that functions, the big, big tires and just everything that that airplane has become now with, you know, full Garmin glass, autopilots, it's changed the mission profile for that airplane where it's not just a toy. It is something substantially more than that, something safer than that, and just doesn't get tired.
No, that's awesome. That is super cool. The stories we have today are really interesting, but before we go any further, I do want to take a moment to acknowledge our sponsor. They are some of the people who help make the Green Dot possible, and that is Crew Chief Systems. Are you still relying on paper logs or manual spreadsheets to manage your aircraft? It's time to elevate your approach. Crew Chief Systems puts your airplane at the center of real-time aircraft asset intelligence, allowing you to fly safer, save time, and protect your aircraft's value. Crew Chief's intuitive platform unifies all of your maintenance, compliance, and operational data, giving you instant access to your aircraft's full history, upcoming requirements, and real-time insights directly from your mobile device or computer. Whether you're a pilot, fleet manager, or mechanic, Crew Chief Systems helps you stay compliant, make smarter decisions, and keep your aircraft in peak condition. Visit crewchiefsystems.com to see how you can modernize your aircraft management. And as a special thank you to Green Dot listeners, you can save 15% for the lifetime of your Crew Chief GA subscription when you use coupon code GREEN15. That's GREEN15 at crewchiefsystems.com. Thank you again so much to Crew Chief Systems for sponsoring the Green Dot and helping make it possible. Now let's get back to the rest of the story. So what is, I guess, the biggest difference for those who have never done it between flying off of like a paved runway and grass? What's the, can you just kind of walk us through the different feels of that?
You know, paved runway to grass in the exact same airplane. So apples to apples, airplane being the same. Really, grass is a more forgiving environment. It's certainly better for tires, especially the very, very expensive large Tundra tires. Now we can get the largest tire that you can put on a Husky is 35 inch, which is a very large tire. And they're $5,000-$6,000 a piece. So that is certainly part of it. So it's a more forgiving environment without question. But I think probably the biggest ones are a lot of the really, really special places to go in an airplane like this. There aren't paved runways, and that's certainly part of the charm. When you think about all of these really, really neat grass strips and recreational opportunities that exist out there, many of them don't even have trails into those places for a pickup truck or ATV. So when you think about leaving small footprint behind, an airplane is probably one of the most phenomenal ways to access some of these really, really neat places and do so with as little footprint as possible. So
do you have a favorite place you've flown into like that, that's special for you guys? Either one of you have a favorite?
I mean, I think my favorite Husky trip was certainly immediately after I got my tailwheel endorsement in the Husky. Matt and I took a trip out to Gateway, Colorado, and I don't know how many airports we landed out there, but it was a phenomenal way to like immediately put my tailwheel endorsement to work and go land at some of these somewhat challenging strips, but really just scenic, picturesque that you can't even describe with a photo. You just can't compare it.
Yeah. Airplanes, like, you know, everybody that sees a big tire airplane thinks it's from Alaska, that doesn't know anything about airplanes. And a lot of folks that know something about airplanes think that the big tires all live in Idaho. And the fact of the matter is, you know, we host this large event, pre-Oshkosh fly-in at Charlie 29. And I was flying with a bunch of friends of mine that do live out there and have big tire airplanes of all sorts. And one of their comments was, boy, it's so beautiful here, you know, rolling cornfields of Wisconsin. And I agree it is. But at the same time, it registered that everywhere is beautiful, especially when it's somewhat foreign to you. So these airplanes, everywhere you go in them, there's opportunities to see something through the open door of a Husky flying slow and low. And, you know, some of my favorite places, of course, are these places that are foreign to us too. So going out Ryan Field, Montana, the kind of the opening to Glacier, beautiful, unbelievable. Bentonville, the trigger gaps and some of the really amazing things that those folks down there have done with that network of grass strips. Really amazing, beautiful places.
That's awesome. Like you said, there is something special when you're somewhere foreign because it does feel like you're exploring or something. You know, I got to go into Sedona, Arizona, mm-hmm. and that was truly, truly just, and it was like right in like the morning. I mean, it was just absolutely beautiful. Lighting was the right way. That airport's, of course, iconic and, you know, kind of up
on a vista there.
Yeah. They actually had certain shirts that said, you know, they were basically calling it an aircraft carrier. I can't remember how the shirts worded it, but it was like the USS Sedona or something. So,
yeah.
But, you know, just, you know, beautiful topography and stuff like that. So I get it. I mean, and the airplanes allow you to do that. They allow you to go somewhere that I always say that we get to go see stuff that normal people don't, you know, I mean, people that just aren't into this, you know, you almost feel bad. They'll never see some of the beauty that's just out there from flying into these different airports and just going out and exploring. That's awesome. I've got to ask you, cause you're like living the dream. And I have to ask you about buying your own airport. That sounds like an absolute adventure that could easily be a movie. Can you guys tell me about how that happened?
Well, I believe it was about 18 months ago that we actually closed on the property. We've been living out there since November, but we've owned it quite a bit longer, a little bit longer than that. And Matt's been dreaming about buying this property probably from before we ever met. He's not stopped talking about living at Sugar Ridge, buying Sugar Ridge since we met.
I was advised by a friend of mine when we bought our J3 to go visit this place. And every airport is special, but some are more specialer. And Sugar Ridge really is at kind of the very entrance to the unglaciated of Wisconsin. And a rather short 1,600-foot grass strip exists on top of a ridge that has views in every direction. And the previous owner, Tom Kretschmann, who still lives there and has become a very good friend of our entire family, our kids love him and they have their own kind of adventures. And it's kind of gone exactly the way that you would hope a situation like this would go, because Sugar Ridge is special, but there's a lot of places like it that are special that are going to need somebody to take it on, not develop it into a 300-home neighborhood and things like that. But Tom Kretschmann built something special, not just because of the airport itself. It really is a museum of sorts as well. A lot of small buildings built around a thing, a really neat fire engine, fire station, you know, that sort of thing. And a very, very large hangar. There's 12,000 some odd square feet of hangar with a lot of neat vintage airplanes, Stomp, Pete and Poles, you know, all these really, really neat things and historical artifacts. And the fact is that owning that place is an endeavor, both in the work that it takes to maintain it. It's not an inexpensive thing to do. And being able to ensure that it stays the way that it does for at least as long as we're alive was something that was really, really neat. So this friend suggested I go out there, and that was a lot of years ago. And it finally came to be where we were able to make this happen and have everybody feel good about it. Tom also did a lot of fly-ins. So a lot of folks in Wisconsin and Northern Illinois know Sugar Ridge and know the events that he would have. We're doing a lot of remodeling right now and doing some things out there. And once it's a safe environment for people to be at again, we'll continue those traditions of sharing that kind of amazing place with community and, you know, the specific pilot community.
You know, it's funny you mention that. One of the things that I would get to do a lot when I was a controller was I would get sent out to talk to the community about the importance of having a general aviation airport, that, you know, it's not just this piece of land that you're not welcome on, that you are welcome, that it's important to the community. You know, can you speak to that effort at all, that sort of trying to make sure people know that your general aviation airport is a very, very important part of your community?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it's an easy thought process to have, right? As the general population drives by an airport that's surrounded by fences, it looks to be off limits. It gets the rap as the rich man's playground. People that have money can afford to fly, can own an airplane. That's the only people that are welcome there. And we've been working really hard to change that by welcoming the public onto the field for events. We've hosted car shows. We've hosted, as Matt mentioned, the pre-Oshkosh fly-in. And that's an ongoing battle, right, of just constantly providing education, but then also getting the community involved in your local airport to understand it does a lot more. You're not getting those Amazon packages in 2 days because of Dane County Truax Field or the larger commercial airfields. The freight runners are coming into Middleton, our local home airport, and they're doing local delivery type stuff.
Well, and building new pilots, you know, small airports like Charlie 29 is where pilots become pilots. And my hope with watching our kids that are small and kind of what they do and how they live, you know, my hope is that in this world where we've got tablets and phones as kind of so predominant with kids, is that technology can inspire as opposed to replace real life experiences. And that they, you know, they see those things, because that's not going away either. You know, the kids having tablets and whatnot, but that it can inspire them to want to be, you know, whatever it is that they want to be, you know, right? And in this context, pilots and that sort of thing. But flight training does not exist without small airports like that. And I think it's hard work to do those events. It's a big lift. And a lot of people, to EAA's credit, Young Eagle is a big component of that. And the pancake breakfast is a big component of that. But the fact is that airports are big open areas. And you can do a lot of neat things with the right safety measures and people in place to help do that and approve some of those things and make it a compelling thing to have the community come out as often as possible to things that are interesting. That, you know, our hangar is pretty. It's very neat inside. And we have donated that space over and over and over to some really, really neat charitable functions. And those folks think it's neat to be in a hangar. You guys do the same thing here, you know, on a different level. It's way cool seeing P-51s and all the great things that are here, but just being on an airfield feels neat to folks. So when people offer up those opportunities, the community has rallied around that. And you have an opportunity to instill in people a good feeling about airports. So when somebody, you know, and they inevitably will, complains about the noise or whatever it is, that there's good feelings in the community more so. And it's incumbent on everybody who cares about aviation to do those things.
You know, it's interesting. When I was working out at Elkhart, there was a gentleman named Chuck Marshall there, and Chuck would have a Stearman and a T-6 clinic. And we would usually get a couple other types of warbirds and stuff like that. And it was always amazing. The first year we had it, I don't think there was the idea that the public even wanted to come and see it. And then I can just remember working the tower, looking down along County Road 6, and there was just tons of people at the fence. So the next year, we actually opened it up, and we let people come in, and there were times where it was a hot ramp and times where it wasn't. But this was not an air show. It was just a clinic. But people just wanted to come and be in the environment. They just wanted to watch these things start up and taxi around and sort of smell them and stuff like that. You know, smell the exhaust and hear the big rumble of everything. And we did that for several years. But like you said, there is an interest there. If you do something like that, the community will turn out. They want to, it's different. It's not the same old, you know, thing. And a lot of times the kids are kind of proud of that when they go to school on Monday and they're like, oh, what did you do? Like, oh, we got a chance to go up near some airplanes, or we went to a fly-in or something like that. And they're kind of excited to have something different to share with their friends rather than just, you know, I was on Xbox all weekend or whatever. It's fun to give them that experience. Or something else I've noticed is kids that do like to do, you know, play video games or flight sims and stuff like that, when they get a chance to go experience the real thing, they can associate to it a little bit because they've played it like on their flight sim. Or, you know, I was working with some kids to clean up a C-47. And I remember they had played Call of Duty. And like the World War II one was like, you had to be a paratrooper and jump out of a C-47. And it was funny because they're like tapping on the airplane and they're like, well, where's all the armor plating? And, you know, we're like, yeah, there's no armor on a C-47, you know. But it was very cool that they kind of walked away looking at a video game they really enjoy completely different because they got to go inside and get in one of these airplanes. And just another avenue of getting them excited about it.
Yeah, you know, and things change and evolve with everything. And, you know, you watch when we take an airplane, you know, a Cirrus, to a fly-in event, you know, it's a big computer. It's got big screens. And kids love that because it feels familiar to them. So, you know, everything evolves and kind of moves along. But I think that the interest in flying is a constant. It just is a little bit different in kind of how they feel about it and what inspires them to want to do the same activity. But the event, Rock the Ramp, that we talked about, I said that's a big thing. And last year we had, you know, 10,000 plus folks there. But it doesn't all have to be those big, big things either. You know, a natural ally of an airport event is a food truck. It's made life very easy. You know, you've got a show going on at the airport anyway. You got food. People are pretty happy. You know, you look at the success of Waukesha, where, you know, we're based now too. Kurt Stanich, the airport manager there, has done just a phenomenal job in bringing the community out for things, you know, simple things. Come out, have lunch. There's a couple food trucks. It doesn't need to be harder than that. Just do something.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I give them a reason to come check out the airport, you know, in the airfield. And that's kind of a little bit of like what your RAF project's about, right? Sort of making sure people understand how important a general aviation airport is.
Well, the RAF does something very specific, and that group is really, it's an amazing group of people. And I think, you know, your vibe attracts your tribe, right? And the RAF are folks that fly tailwheel airplanes to beautiful places to volunteer their whatever it is that they have, their times, their abilities, their tools, their machinery, to protect some of the most amazing of these grass strips. And a lot of them require something more from a regulatory standpoint. They're negotiating with the Bureau of Land Management, with Forest Service. It's bigger than just, you know, one little grass strip. And what they're doing to make sure that these places stay open, are maintained, get reopened, all of that is a pretty compelling and amazing thing to watch. And I got to know them through a good friend, Charlie 29 Jeff Russell, who would have small spring party and talk about what the RAF was doing. And it piqued my interest because it was the kind of flying that I like to do and the kind of people that I like to be around. And it was about a year and a half ago where, you know, asking the question, how can I help? You know, some people can cook amazing volunteer meals, and some people have big tractors that they can bring to these things and do work quickly. Well, one of the things that I could do was build an airplane, right? And have Aviat build a RAF branded machine to take and inspire folks to understand, you know, their brand more. We're dependent on each other. Grass strips, backcountry airplane. And to do something together like that was a power of partnership and just bringing awareness to their mission, you know, through our airplane was something that we could do. And it's on the cover of Flying Magazine this month. So it was a very rewarding thing to see a project that, you know, many people came together to do being celebrated in that way. And the airplane is beautiful and it's an amazing thing. So
I love that. You know, it's something I remember. There's a great aviation documentary. If people haven't seen it, it's one near and dear to my heart. It was called 1/6 Right.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a quote in there that I never forgot. And the guy said, you know, we're not building more airports. You know, we're once they close an airport and that land gets reused for something else,
they're
that's
gone.
It's gone. You can't, it's too late. You can't bring it back. So I love that, you know, you guys have an effort to keep that going, whether it's at your home airport, the airports that you're out there helping. We're trying to, you know, you guys are trying to save them. And especially what I'd like to say is, you know, you jump in the deep end, you're down there helping, which is really cool. That is a good way to keep general aviation and these sort of backcountry flying avenues still there. It's vital. It reminds me of a very like nature approach to the airports, if that makes sense, like how you would when you're out in a national park or something like that.
Well, and it's neat, you know, a lot of, I think people would say that their airports and leadership doesn't necessarily like new ideas and that that's been challenging for some. And in fact, at times doesn't even like the new ideas of the business we do. You know, I'll make a great example. Hangars are in great demand. Well, there's land, folks. Let's figure out how to do it. And how people encounter resistance to this can be difficult, but the folks who are embracing new ideas, events that are different and, you know, facilities that are different and that sort of thing are seeing great success. And to the backcountry model, having some of these airports have a place at the end that's quiet, that has, you know, a shower facility, a tie down, a campfire ring, you know, those are things not always seen on airports. And when an airport has the ability to add something like that nicely, again, it just brings in more people. So be open to ideas for new things. Like I said, everything changes, but it all stays the same too.
Wow. Well, thank you guys for what you're doing for aviation, for general aviation, and for airports to keep them going. You painted quite a picture. It's almost like the field of dreams for Sugar Ridge is what it sounds like to me. So that's super cool. Do you have any sort of closing things you want to touch on, or do you think we?
I mean, I guess, you know, as I hear Matt talk about aviation and the RAF, aviation takes on a lot of different forms, right? It's not just about the airplanes. It's about the people. It's about people passionate in aviation. It's not about just the small backcountry planes. It's not just about the big jets or the commercial airliners. I think it's everything together. And there's people passionate about everything. You know, just because this is what we're passionate about, and frankly, Matt and I are on a lot of different ends of the spectrum sometimes, but aviation has a lot to offer, even if you're just passionate. Like, just get out there, figure out what it is that you love, and chances are there'll be something in aviation that matches that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that first step, just going to the airport, whatever your local GA airport is, because it you kind of figure it out. I mean, for me, it was all about warbirds when I was getting in there, but I was volunteering at an air museum at an early age. However, when my buddy brought me here, suddenly I'm looking at a stagger wing, and I dare you to look at a stagger wing and not think that it's absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, so it's just that kind of the opportunity to get exposed to a lot of the different avenues is important. I think you end up finding your favorites in all the different areas. So.
Well, and I think inherently as pilots, we want to share our passion. And so, yeah, you show up to your airport, chances are we're going to want to talk about what we're doing or what we flew in or what we like flying. Go to any local FBO and you see a lot of that. And we see a lot of that up at Sugar Ridge as folks fly in and we just sit and do a bit of hangar talking.
I think that's why AirVenture has become, you know, is the tremendous success. And I've watched that change. Like, this is my 37th year. It's changed and it's grown and it's just so diverse. There's something for everybody that loves airplanes.
Yeah.
Something for everybody. And that event just embodies that. And it's such a tremendous thing. You know, we'll never miss it.
That's awesome. Well, thank you guys for making the trip up to be on here today. I can't wait to see you guys. I've met two more now, new friends in the aviation world. Can't wait to see you guys at Oshkosh as well. For all those out there, I think this has been kind of a sort of a call to action to go out and check out your local general aviation airport, whichever airport it is, and see where you can get involved. And I guarantee you won't be disappointed. And I always tell everybody, whether it's a museum or whatever, start volunteering at it. I guarantee you your life will never be the same in a very good way. So thank you guys so much for coming up. Thank you to all of our listeners who give us good comments. All the bad comments we just send over to Tom and he can deal with those. But all joking aside, thank you guys for listening, for your support, and again, for your positive reviews and ratings. So thank you guys so much. We'll catch you next time when we're cleared to land on the Green Dot.